Okay, this is episode
26.
I'm just going to keep counting the shows because it's fun. You might have heard this guy on the latest Peach and Black podcast episode. He is from Lake Minnetonka. It is Adam Rudiger. Hello, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm listening to Madhouse. Well, I was just before we started this.
So either you're great or you're very disappointed that you had to stop listening to Madhouse.
Oh, good point. Let me tell you, and then you tell me.
Okay.
Out of the first two Madhouse albums, I much prefer the second one.
You're in the minority there, I think.
Really?
Based on what I've heard from other people. I think if I had to choose one, it would probably be 8, but I certainly love 16, and there's a lot of really great stuff on it.
I think I'm that way because I got the actual CD, official, the real CD of 16 way before I got 8. Like it would have been like at least probably 3 or 4 years.
So you had serious bonding time with it.
Oh yeah. And then I got 8 and I'm like, 16's way better. And I've hardly listened to 8.
It reminds me of when Sacrifice of Victor came out on VHS around the same time as The Undertaker. They were like within same week.
Yep.
And I really wanted Undertaker. But for some reason, I got Sacrifice of Victor first and I watched it and I was like, this is just all right. And then when I got Undertaker, I was like, oh no, I like Sacrifice of Victor better. So, yeah. and now Sacrifice of Victor has taken its true rightful place in my rankings. Mm. So it's one of the best videos released, I think.
Well, it's one of the very few properly filmed after shows that we've got. So just for that, it's way up there.
Oh, it's amazing. Like the way that there's so many cameras and they get right up all in the action. It's fantastic.
You know, as soon as you say Sacrifice of Victor, I just instantly think of the guitar solo in Call the Law. It's the first thing I think of every single time.
Isn't it amazing?
It is insane.
I wasn't sure when I first got the Money Don't Matter Tonight, you know, CD single with the holographic.
A hologram. Kind of
yeah. And I was like, is this by a different band? Is this really by the NPG? And then,
yeah, it was a bit different. Yeah.
It was a bit different. And then, of course, like you listen to the guitar in the background, you're like, no, that's Prince. That's Prince's sort of language on the guitar. And it's such a great track. I'm so glad the NPG are performing that live to this day.
Yeah. You saw them when they came here. Was it last year?
Yeah.
Yeah, last year. Oh, it was so good when they played that. You know, you do miss Prince on the guitar, but still, just to hear them do Call the Law, it's great.
Call the Law and Juice and a Quarter were the two highlights of that entire gig for me.
Juice and a Quarter. As soon as that riff started, I was sitting there next to MC and we just both looked at each other and we're like, no way. That was so funny.
And if they wanted to top that, they could have pulled out Return of the Bump Squad or something, but they didn't. Nothing off Exodus, not even Get Wild or The Good Life. It was pretty strange.
Well, a few shows they have played The Good Life in Europe with Sonny singing it. So there's still hope because Sonny is coming to Caloundra in October. So I've put in a request. We'll see.
I wouldn't ordinarily go to Caloundra, but if Sonny
yeah, T it's not a big destination, but I'll do it to see Sonny T.
It's worth it.
Back to Madhouse. Madhouse 16. Just the first track, 9. Unbelievable.
I agree.
That is just such a mental track. I love it. Like 9 and 12, my two favorite tracks on the album. 12 just has got that total, like, this is like a 50s game show and it's great. But 9, I mean, apart from being just an insane track, I mean, what an intro to an album. It just blows your head off every time.
I like 13, particularly the 12-inch version.
Ah.
That remix 13, version.
The Paisley Park mix.
Yeah. So good. It's just got this kind of apocalyptic feel about it. It's really like the sounds in it are so cold.
Mm.
Whatever the reverb they used. When I was at Paisley, Tommy, the tour guide, showed me one of the desks in one of the studios. And he goes, yeah, that's the desk where they recorded all the Madhouse albums. I was like, shut up. It was in Studio B, actually. Shut up, Tommy. Oh, my God. And he goes, but you can't go in there. He was teasing.
Here is a chat we had only a few days ago, and you tell the story about Tommy, the tour guide at Paisley Park. So here it is right now.
The other incredible thing that happened at Paisley, so I didn't actually go to official celebration, but I went to Paisley Park on my last day in Minneapolis as Dr. Fink's guest because the Revolution were performing and he got me in. And when I got there, they showed this concert video in the main soundstage, and then Tommy is this, not Tommy Barbarella, Tommy is this tour guide at Paisley Park that I'm friends with on Facebook. And he came up to me and he goes, Adam, it's Tommy. And I've never met him in real life, obviously. And I'm like, oh, yeah, hey, Tommy, how are you? And he goes, I'm so glad you're here. I love your music. And I'm thinking, what the hell is going on? I've come to Paisley Park and the tour guide is telling me he not only knows about our music, but he loves it. And he says, I'm going to take this tour now. You should be in my tour group. And I said, okay, cool. I don't really know what I'm doing. I just got this lanyard that gets me into stuff. So cool. So we go into Studio A and he plays everybody. There's about 20 of us in this tour group. He plays in this, the track. It's called Soul Patch. And it's from Black is the New Black. So the last thing that Prince was recording, another jazzy kind of record right before he died with Adrian Crutchfield on sax and Mono Neon and Kirk Johnson on drums. Mm. And he plays about a minute of this funky track and then he stops it and he goes, now everybody, if you like music like this, then you have to check out Lake Minnetonka, this band from Melbourne, Australia. And I'm like, what the hell? And he gave me this big rap to the group. Wow, and then he kept bringing people up to meet me during the day. He was like, have you met Ingrid Chavez? I'm like, no. He goes, oh, come over, I'll introduce you. What? So that was a hell of a day. And see the Revolution twice. Meet Lisa Coleman at First Avenue in the morning before we went over there. And yeah, I had an amazing time at Paisley. So Tommy, if you're listening, thank you, buddy. I really appreciate that.
So there you go.
I feel like minutes have gone by since
we're
in our own little Paisley world.
It's so funny. If anyone else listened to this show and like doesn't know all this stuff, we're like, oh, Nine's the best thing ever. And people are like, well, what's happening? What is this all about?
Look, but they've had like 35 years to get onto this stuff, you know?
That's right. Like,
we can't spoon feed them everything. Come on.
Because we haven't talked about originals enough. What are your thoughts on that album?
I enjoyed it immensely. I think it's a really good release from the estate. I don't think all the songs are improved in their, you know, original versions. You know, I think the Maserati version of 100 Miles Per Hour is vastly superior. I think Baby Your Trip is vastly superior, the Jill Jones version.
But you love that Jill Jones album more than anything, so that's understandable.
I do love the Jill Jones album. I mean, you know, I don't love the version of With You. Mm. I mean, I like it better than the Prince version, but I just don't think it's a very good song. And I know that on the Peach and Black podcast, you discussed at length why the hell it was even included. And it's because I guess Prince kind of wanted it, you know, kind of offered it to her. But I don't think that was the strongest material. But anyway, back to Baby Your Trip. Yeah, the Jill Jones version's fantastic. I mean, the Prince version's good to hear kind of where it came from, but I think it scrubs up better on Jill Jones. But what does improve is Makeup. And I love the original version of Makeup, but the sounds, they're even more glitchy and weird on the Prince version. And I was like, why? It's like they cleaned it up. It's like they made it a bit more radio friendly or something. Which is weird because it's not like it was going to get played on radio anyway. But I was surprised when I heard it. There was like some really different stuff going on sonically.
Like I panned that track. I panned it when it was on, when the original one came out, and same here. It's just
not a favorite.
It's, I don't know if it's the style of the music or the fact that it's basically just a 4-second riff that just goes for, you know, 3 minutes with him just saying random words. I don't see the appeal of it, but that's just me. I don't know.
Yeah, for me, it's a vibe thing. I really like the kind of gritty, mean kind of synths. It seems quite pessimistic, the sound of the song. And it's kind of a weird character that he's playing and then that Apollonia is playing. But I must say that was a big inspiration for the Lake Minnetonka song Hoops. And when Fran and I were discussing how we were going to have the lyrics delivered, I said, I think it should be totally deadpan.
Let me just play you this song. Let me just play you a little song and have a listen to this.
That's right. Well, she knows it, but we really zoomed in on it, and I said, I think it should be deadpan. Just be like completely disinterested when you do the vocals, and then we multi-tracked them, so it's 3 or 4 layers deep of Fran deadpanning all the lyrics. It was definitely inspired by Makeup. And the other track that I think really shines is Gigolos Get Lonely Too, because that is not a song that I ever related to or thought anything of the Time version. Not that into, but there's actually like an emotional depth to it that Prince is able to convey that I feel that kind of Morris doesn't. And maybe it's because Morris was going right off a Prince guide vocal and was just concerned with nailing the performance that Prince wanted him to nail. But there's just something extra in there. And now I like it so much more. The Time version I don't like any more than I did before, but it was so great to hear that version. Did you have a different feeling on that?
Yeah, same thing. I wrote off Gigolos on the Time album, mostly because it's a ballad and Morris Day singing it, and like that's just comedy straight away. So
I agree.
So it's, you couldn't take it seriously in that way, but then I also didn't think it was a very good song. And then you get the Prince version. And I get what you're saying, you know, Prince better than almost anyone can emote with his vocal, but I still don't think the song's that good. It's okay.
There's that
one. I just couldn't believe, yeah.
There's that one chord at the end of the chorus that gets me, just the like the last
there chord. There are a few things in there and you're just like, oh, yeah.
There's some great details. I mean, the thing I love about Prince is even when he's totally writing a tune in his sleep, you know, a 12-bar blues or whatever, there's always just some arrangement idea that makes it pop, makes it, you know, worth listening, with the exception of Hot Summer. But 99% of the time,
yeah,
it's the arrangement that brings it to life as much as the composition. You know?
Like one of the annoying things was that there's supposedly like a full version of Gigolos and it's like 10 minutes or something.
Why didn't we get
version,
that?
Exactly. The version on the Time album was pretty much the same as what we got on original. It was just like 4 minutes something. But again, if there's a full version, what are you doing? What are you doing?
It touches me the songs that, I mean, I assume it all in good time and they will come out eventually. But still all that vault stuff from the 80s, like Rebirth of the Flesh and There's Others Here With Us and things like that. Never been officially released. The original version of Old Friends for Sale would be nice.
Yeah.
And people do say, oh, but is that what Prince would have wanted? To which I respond, if he wanted anything and wanted it to be enacted after his death, should have had a will.
Exactly. I was waiting for that. That's exactly right. If he had any care to what was going to happen to the vault, then there was an easy way to solve that problem.
Very easy.
And he chose not to, so end of story, really.
I wonder if his lawyer or one of them was like, Prince, do you think we should get onto that will thing? He's like, no, keep scrolling YouTube. Find those videos.
Of that baby dancing to Let's Go Crazy for 4 seconds and let's sue them. That's the way. That's the way forward.
He said, send them a C&D and the lawyer, oh, cease and desist. Yeah, that's what Prince would want. Prince meant send him chaos and disorder. You know, I need to get rid of these CDs I've got under my bed.
Yeah, he went a bit crazy on that stuff. But it is still hard to believe that he didn't have a will. I mean, he went through lawyers like anything, like at least every couple of years there were new people around. And
he could have ridden his bike down to the post office and just got a do-it-yourself will kit.
Will kit, exactly.
Yeah.
But every single lawyer that came into the scene, you know, isn't it their like duty to like bring up like, you know, I just went through all the papers of the previous guy. Notice there's no will.
Maybe
we should get on that.
Through so nope. many lawyers. Every time the
as soon as they
says,
brought up the will, he dumped
I've
them.
Just noticed Prince is like, you're out of here. It's like, what did I do? It's like, you're just like all the rest.
You're trying to help me protect my future. No, get out of here.
Do you think it had something to do with his religion? Like he figured that when you're gone, whatever else doesn't matter. And he's gone to the next realm and it's irrelevant?
Well, no, it is relevant, but you know, as
it's
we know,
it's not relevant to him anymore.
No, but his view on religion changed that many times. You know, maybe post like 1998, 99, it was like, no, I'm not doing that. But you know, Purple Rain making millions and millions of dollars. How could there not be something even then for lawyers to say, you know, maybe you should put something on paper to look after this stuff. And even back then, it's hard to believe.
Maybe when I was at Paisley, I should have looked in the piano stool or like under the cushion on the couch and just made sure.
Exactly. It could be anywhere. Do you know
hey
what?
Guys, I think you missed something.
Wouldn't it be amazing? I actually just read this somewhere in the last few days and they're like, imagine if they're going through all these vault tapes and they actually find a tape. and he's recorded his will. The amazing thing is, yeah, they might not get to that.
It's called I Will. It's on Chaos and Disorder.
But imagine if that existed. Imagine if he just recorded like 10 minutes of, you know, I want this to happen. It might not even be legally binding because it's got to be signed and witnessed and all that stuff. But imagine if they found that. And the stupid thing is they might not find it for another 10 years to like go through all the tapes. It's just crazy.
Like, whatever you do, never bring out my version of Gigolo's Get Lonely Too. They're like,
No, especially that piano and the microphone thing from 1983. I never want anyone to hear that. No, it's just the first release that they blast all over the world. Good plan.
I want you to take the vault and move it to a mountain in LA. Hey, cool.
No, we got something.
We fluked
right.
it.
Oh, God. But you said 100 miles an hour. Mm. Like, I don't mind this version on the album. It is still very funky. But that guitar that's just all over it, I don't think that's meant to be there. It really just sounds like they found the tape and they're like, just push it all up. If he recorded it, it's meant to be there.
Yeah.
That little guitar noodling just everywhere over that track. Some of it's funky. Some of it's not so good, but most of it's pretty good. But that could have just been him just stuffing around just for fun. Never even intended to be on any mix. But then we get this with this wanky guitar all over the track. And it's just like, it's hard to know. You know, it's weird.
But it's also hard to be judicious, like who gets to go in and decide which guitar lick is in and which guitar lick is out.
Exactly. That's one of the things that they've got to figure out. It's like, how far can they go with, you know, creative decisions, like with stuff like that?
Well, this is something that I've talked many times about with my manager, Claire. And she had the idea that you could get different people like Susan Rogers, Eric Leeds, Dr. Fink, whoever, you know, insiders, to come up with a list of what they would want to see released. And then you have some kind of, I don't know, fan voting system to decide on the track list. I'd like to know what was going to come out on Crystal Ball 2.
Well, I voted on those tracks.
Even though Crystal Ball for me is, it's weird because the modern songs and remixes and things are in with, you know, older stuff like Crystal Ball and Sexual Suicide. I would have preferred that it was more era specific.
Yeah.
You know, but that's okay. We have the option now to create our own playlist. So I just, you know, uncheck the box for She Gave Her Angels and get on with, but I do like Pum Pum though, so.
Well, it is weird because even though it is all over the place, it is pretty much 85, 86 stuff and 93, 94 stuff with a couple of other randoms as well. But I remember when it was coming out, it was like, it's an official bootleg. So that, again, that's his sense of humor. It's like, I'm going to make this just like all those rubbish bootlegs, but it'll sound good. But I'm going to put like, you know, 93 tracks and 86 tracks, and they're all just going to be mixed together just like on all these stupid bootlegs.
Do you think the Gold Experience has the perfect level of compression on everything? Well, then you're going to love this new mix of Sexual Suicide slammed to the top of the dynamic range. I'm going to win the loudness wars with a song I made in 1985. Booyah.
That was probably the biggest problem with that entire release was that.
The other thing which I found interesting was the overdubs on the live stuff, like Days of Wild.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
What is your favorite version of Days of Wild?
Good question. Well, I guess it's sort of it is like the original version, which was on that Beautiful Experience TV show.
100% agree with you. That is the definitive version of Days of Wild. You are correct, Captain.
Good.
That was so unbelievably awesome. When I taped that off TV,
do you know what? I still have the clipping from the TV guide. It was on at 11:35 p.m.
Right.
I still have the clipping from the TV guide. The Beautiful Experience. 11:35, I think it was on Channel 9. I'm not sure though.
I would have stayed up for that. So wherever I was, it was like 4 a.m. and I missed the beginning of Interactive.
Oh no.
So I didn't see the first couple of minutes of Beautiful Experience till years later. But Days of Wild, I loved it so much I taped it off the TV onto like a cassette tape and I just like listened to it like endlessly on the way to school and on the way home from school on my Walkman. I just thought it was the most colossal track and I loved the video clip. And yeah.
Is that the one where he's like the girls are driving the car?
Yeah, he's
like
hanging out the top of
the
car
with the guitar. Yeah. playing his simple guitar hanging out the back. It's crazy.
And he kind of favored these thin guitar sounds at the time, even when they were heavily affected. But that's kind of like a really clean, twangy sound.
Yeah.
And it's funny because when he plays it live, he has it in the backing track as well. I guess Morris Hayes triggers a sample of the guitar solo. With dollops of distortion and wah and things, but he still kind of plays it clean. And sometimes he would even play it on bass. I had the bootleg, which was La Bataclan, which was an audience recording.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which was great. And that was the first time I heard like Babies Making Babies and Hair being inserted into those songs when I was just starting to discover Graham Central Station and Sly and the Family Stone, because you couldn't get that stuff. You couldn't just go down to JB or get on that, you know, Spotify and listen to the, you'd heard about these bands, but you didn't get to actually hear what they sounded like for ages. There was no YouTube. Oh, those were the days.
The internet changed everything.
If only I could go back in time and go, don't pay $50 for that CD. You get it for free in 10 years. I promise you, you'll hear it before you die.
Exactly. Exactly. But, oh, yeah. You think about the money of CDs that's just sitting on the shelf collecting dust and you just cry.
Yeah.
Very sad. But also then another good version of Days of World was the one from the other TV special, The Love for One Another One.
Yes, that's really a good funky version. They sort of syncopate the groove more. It's really good, isn't it?
But the version on Crystal Ball, not so good.
Yeah,
the version
he put out,
I think, 2001 or two, not so good. It sort of seemed to get heavier and heavier, but it didn't get better.
And it got more and more G-rated. And by the end, the nadir for me is when he says, instead of motherfucking liar, he says big old liar.
Big old liar.
Big old liar. Come on. Come on.
It's like 6 years old.
God.
You're a big old liar.
You're a big old liar.
You're calling a big old liar. You're a big old liar.
Pop music's all kind of wrong. Yeah, I don't know.
But even worse, like the 2012 lyrics of Days of Wild were so, you know, you could sing that to babies. It was just, it was almost embarrassing. Like when you know where it came from, like the original lyrics, and you're like, how far have you fallen to doing the big old liar? It's just hilarious, really.
I mean, he's got lots of options. He could never perform the song again, like he did with many songs. It's not like he doesn't have many other monster jams, or he could just write another monster jam, although let's hope it doesn't turn out like Act of God. And you could do it instrumentally, you know.
He stopped playing Darling Nikki ages ago, but he still teased it now and then, and occasionally he'd play a little bit of it.
Yeah, he was quite playful with that sort of stuff. You know, he'd start a song and people would be like, oh my God, he's going to do it. And then he'd be like,
nah.
There's that version in Beautiful Experience, the video. They're playing All Blues, the Miles Davis tune, for a little bit. And it sounds so cool. And I would love to hear sort of that era in NPG jamming on more jazz stuff. And it was weird when they had the 3121, that sort of like, you know, have that jazz room in Vegas.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Jazz cuisine.
Looking at the track list, it was always really dusty stuff, like really old, daggy jazz tunes. It didn't seem to be too hip. Prince had a very interesting relationship to jazz. I've thought about this a lot, and I think maybe I'll do my master's on it. But, you know, talking to Eric and talking to Matt about Prince's involvement with jazz, he tended to recruit people around him who were far more versed in the jazz vocabulary that could bring those flavors to his music. And, yeah, so he had kind of flavors that he knew how to do, but he really didn't have the harmonic and melodic vocabulary of the jazz idiom. That's not to say he wasn't an amazing improviser.
But with serious jazz stuff, if you're not educated in that way, you can't just walk in and do it.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter because all those flavors are in his music because he's got Eric Leeds and he just got smoother. You know, he started with Eric and Eddie M occasionally and then ends up with Najee. Najee.
Well, even that last, was it MPGQ?
Yeah, and that was around the same time as Black is the New Black, isn't it? So that was Adrian Crutchfield. And
it is, yeah.
And even Xavier Taplin, haven't... who is just here for with Ghost Note. So he's a great player.
Like, even though we heard little from that NPGQ thing, it did seem to be, you know, even softer, like smoother. It might have had a bit of an edge to it, but we haven't heard much of it to know. But I doubt it.
I really like Xenophobia and things like that that are really hard-hitting, biting kind of instrumental. That's the kind of stuff that I like to try and write for Lake Minnetonka.
Expectation. That's a good album.
Yeah, and there's great stuff on C-Note as well. Nagoya, I think, is my favorite. So good.
You can thank me for Expectation being released, if you didn't know.
Do tell.
Okay, it was... I got to think of the story now. I just know that the start of it and then I forget. Okay, it was the 26th of November 2002 in Fukuoka in Japan. And at the MPG Music Club soundcheck, I was in there. And me and, I don't know, about 40, 50 other people, all Japanese from memory, who spoke little to zero English. So who did he end up talking to? Me. And I said to him, amongst many things, is because he'd put like that little, I don't know, 20, 30 second Xenophobia teaser on whichever website he had at the time. And I'm like,
was the studio version of Xenophobia?
Yeah, yeah, which never came out.
No, but it sounded good.
Oh, I said, yeah, it sounded great. And I said to him, you have to release the Xenophobia album. And he just looks at me and he's like, what are you, my manager? Which, you know, classic line from him, of course. And I'm like, yes, I'm your manager. And I'm telling you that you need to release that album. And he just laughed. And literally, what, 5 weeks later, that album came out. So you're welcome.
Thank you, Captain.
It came out 1st of January 2003. So I was very happy with that turn of events.
And then what else did you do in your managerial capacity? Did you get him to write a will?
I tried, but, you know, he kicked me out. So, and I didn't see him for years and years and years after that.
Don't call me, I'll call you me.
Yeah. But the funniest thing was when we talked to him in 2010, and I started telling him that, he remembered. And that blew my mind, because you just think how many people he met every, you know, day-to-day life. Maybe not as many as we think, but still, it was 8 years previous to that. And he remembered that I didn't even say it. I said, back in 2002 in Japan, I said this. And he said, without me even prompting him, he said, what are you, my manager? 8 years later, he remembered that he said that. That blew my mind.
Maybe he just says that to everyone.
Probably. It's probably a common thing. And he's like, yep, that's probably what I would have said. So, but still, I'm just like, oh, wow. Because I know he has said that in other situations, but it was just funny that he seemed to remember it.
Those are some great shows. Obviously, I wasn't there in Japan in 2002, but I've heard the bootlegs. They're pretty amazing. That was a great period, I think, for him. He was stretching out. The band sounded particularly good. Like, I'm actually not such a big fan of Renato Netto.
Let's do another one of those internet high fives. Yes, I agree. 100%.
Cool.
With his endless noodling.
He's very clean. He's just a very clean jazz player.
Technically, he's amazing. Give him props for that.
Absolutely.
But fitting into a Prince Van band doing funk and pop stuff, he sort of fit in, but he always seemed like he was like half in, half out to me.
I just want more grit from him. You know, so even his sounds that he used are very kind of polite. Like, I'm going to put some very polite delay on. It's going to be the politest delay you've ever heard. It's not going to be this smeary shit.
On the cleanest piano you can find.
Just yeah. Beautiful. And I'm going to do a Montuno. It's going to be boop, 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 beep, boop, beep, boop, boop, you know. And I just want some Thelonious Monk in there, you know. I want some ugly beauty, you know.
Like I will never say he's not a good player. He's an amazing player. He's not my style, and I don't particularly like the way he played in Prince's band. He did some good things, but I just don't think he fit in. But again, amazing player. Like, you see him doing just his thing in other bands and you're like, holy moly, that's what he does and it's amazing. But he just never like fit for me. I don't know why.
Yeah, but I do think that there are some particular recordings from around 2002 where the entire band was sounding really good. And regardless of what sounds we think we want to hear from a Prince band, Netto fit in to that overall fabric, you know, with Rhonda and Blackwell. And it was really good. I particularly enjoyed Cassie O'Neill. I thought she was a phenomenal keyboard contributor to the NPG, and I would have preferred for her stint to be longer. She was awesome.
Oh, yeah. On those Australian shows, she did some great stuff. Was it Something in the Water that she played?
Yeah,
that
yes.
That was,
yes.
That's yes, great. Yes, yes. Like he even released a version, a live version of that. He thought it was that good. So that says something.
She's an incredible gospel player. And she does that modern gospel stuff, which is extremely harmonically sophisticated. And there was a DVD, an instructional gospel piano DVD featuring her that I bought because I wanted to learn some of that stuff. And it's interesting because there was a guy sort of interviewing her, sort of asking her the questions, oh, can you show us this song or this chord progression? And she really didn't discuss anything in theoretical terms. She'd be like, oh, yeah, well, it's just kind of like I play these notes. And it's almost like when you grow up speaking that language on an instrument, you don't necessarily have the theoretical knowledge to be able to communicate that. You just speak it.
You can't explain it in words. You just do it.
Yeah, you can hear. Where, you know, I probably want an analytical thing where she goes, okay, well, I'm doing a tritone substitution on this chord and then we're playing this in this inversion and then it's this sequence. But no, it wasn't like that at all. She's like, well, I sort of, it's an E and then it's a G sharp and then it's a B and then I move it to this.
Mm.
But, you know, it sounds incredible.
Prince was like that too. Like he did all this weird stuff, but, you know, I doubt he could have actually explained what he was doing.
Oh, can I tell you something funny on that? You know, there's that scene in Graffiti Bridge where he's holding like a stack of sheet music.
Oh,
it says maybe like God is alive or something. And then there's all these dots. I zoomed in on the DVD because I wanted to see what the dots were. And it's like The Shining, all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy. Every page was identical. He sort of flicks through a few pages and I was like, that's the same thing. That's the same thing. Oh my God.
Yeah.
I think he underestimated the level of obsession from his bands, especially like the music nerds who are like, what voicing did Prince use on a song I've never even heard? Oh, it's all fake.
It's nothing. but he's another one who just played stuff. I doubt when he's doing a guitar solo, he's like, oh, now I'm going to do a pentatonic thing. It's like, no, he's just doing it. He's not thinking about what it is or what he thinks what he's doing, but he doesn't think, well, this is what that is, which is good. You don't want to be thinking about that stuff.
I find it fascinating where he's teaching a song to the band. There's one for Another Lonely Christmas and there's a few other ones. It's like, you know, an hour of him going, it's B, and then you go to E, mm-mm, E diminished.
And then I want the horns to go like this. Ba, ba, ba.
Yeah, and then he's micromanaging. He's like, hit that snare a little harder.
Yep.
But yeah, very interesting to hear how he taught it to the band, because I always wondered, you know, it's not like he gives people a chart. With my band, I write out the chart and go, this is your bit, I don't know what your bit is, you know, let's work it out, that kind of thing. But when you join Prince's band and he says, learn these 300 songs, are you meant to transcribe the whole thing off the record? Because often he hid the parts in the mixes. He didn't want you to be able to figure out what it is. And I think it was Levi that said when he joined the band and he was playing bass, Prince made him go to the multi-track, the original multi-track tape
Bass
and isolate the bass. Now that I've heard Junk Music, that would be my next holy grail of bootlegs. If I could hear a tracked version of Alphabet Street, God, because the bass is so poppy and complicated, and it's up very high. It's playing all these fills.
Yeah,
you can barely hear it because it's very deep in the mix, but it's definitely in there. It's some outside stuff. It's fantastic. And then of course later on, Prince always did Alphabet Street with that 4-to-the-floor beat. I like country music too, and it ruined it. I love the beat in Alphabet Street. It's amazing.
It's probably very Sheila
wrote it. Yeah, but then as soon as they put the doof to it, ruins it. It's not Alphabet Street anymore.
When I was in bands years and years ago, we never wrote anything down. It was like, you make the song, you learn the song, you play the song. And it's all just in your head. It was never written down. And you'd have like 20 songs and you just know them. And that was just how it was. And I guess
Imagine if one of those songs was Three Chains of Gold and another one was Crystal Ball.
But it's the same thing though. Once you learn it, you know it. That's it.
It's true. Hey Prince, what's that third chord of Purple Rain again? I keep forgetting.
That's as far as I got. I was trying to learn it. It's just too hard. You wouldn't last too long.
What instrument do you play?
Well, I hardly play anything now because I have arthritis in my hands, but I started playing piano and then guitar and bass. And
you're one of those multi-instrumentalist people.
I'm retired. I did get coaxed back to play guitar at someone's 40th birthday a year or two ago, and we played Peach. So that was fun. Playing that song on guitar, like note for note to the studio version, was really fun.
I bet.
But and considering it was the first time I'd been up in front of anyone in probably 10 years, that was interesting.
How did you go? Was it challenging?
One bad note in the guitar solo. And most people didn't even notice, they say, but it was so obvious to me when I listened back to it. Because, you know, there's a couple of really big bends in one of those solos. One of them just didn't quite make it. And I'm just like, I didn't even notice when I was, maybe I did notice when I was doing it. I can't remember. But listening back to it, I'm just like, oh, no, it was one note off and that was the perfect version. Oh, well.
I've been checking out the guitar solo in Guitar, the song Guitar, and trying to get that on keyboard on a guitar kind of sound.
Oh, and yeah.
Get it to sound good, which is another thing altogether, because you've got to actually play voicings similar to the way they're voiced on guitar. You can't just play your regular piano shapes. Yeah. They don't work if you want it to sound properly like a guitar. So that's been fun. But there's this guy on YouTube, Jason Reed, and he's got about 200 Prince songs broken down, all the guitar and bass parts.
Wow.
He's unreal. And he's got a Patreon that I support, because I just thought, man, this guy has given me so much good information. $3 a month or whatever it is, I'm happy to donate. He's great. Thanks, Jason, if you're listening. Doing a great job.
Yeah, I'll have to have a look. What is it, Jason Reed?
Yeah, R-E-A-D. And he goes, what's up, guitar buddies? Today we're going to be looking at Holy River by Prince. Elephants and Flowers. We're going to do the guitar solo from Super Funky Califragisexy. It goes deep. It's really good.
Did it blow your mind when Prince pulled out Elephants and Flowers in like 2001 and started playing it at like the celebration? That was the most... I saw that on the track list before I listened, and I'm just like, what? He's playing Elephants and Flowers? I mean, it was just like
I always expected him to do wacky stuff. So that stuff never really surprised me. But I think one moment where I was surprised was on the piano and microphone tour when he started doing Black Sweat solo piano. And that made me very happy. I was like, this is awesome. And then the other highlight for me was he did Time, which is one of my favorite tracks from Artificial Age.
Yeah,
I just love that. The vibe on that tune, that could just go for another 20 minutes as far as I'm concerned. It's so good. So that was a surprise.
Shows, shows did you go to? Melbourne ones?
I went to both late shows. Melbourne nights.
So that was what, it was a 16, 17, I think, Melbourne?
Yeah, it was good. One, I had a really good seat, very expensive, really good seat. And the other one I was up in the back, and when I was up in the back, I had really annoying people around me. I had one person who insisted on singing along to everything, and I'm like, he's not doing the album version that you think you know. Shut the fuck up! And and there was someone who was doing that, but they seemed wanting to pick a fight, and they kept turning around. And if I was looking at them, they're like, "What? What are you looking at? What?" Jesus.
Yeah,
so, I rarely go to
shows anymore because, yeah, there's just too many idiots. I just spend half my night looking for possible problems, and I just can't enjoy it anymore, which is sad because I don't drink. And Australians are idiots, and they don't know how to control themselves when they drink. That's quite obvious, especially in Sydney. So
Sydney, they're like, they got to get it in because they're going to stop serving at a certain point. And they're like, oh, my God, I got to get my drink.
Oh, but then you just go to Newtown. It's a problem solved.
Is that what you do? Okay, I'll keep that in mind for when we visit next.
As soon as Sydney closes CBD, everyone just goes to like Newtown or Redfern or somewhere just out of that area and keeps going. If that's something you got to do,
right? So it's only the CBD,
as far as I know. Yeah, I mean, it's been on for years, but since I don't drink and rarely go out anymore, it's not affected me in any way. So
it's probably good health wise.
Yeah, but then all the cheeseburgers probably balance that out. So. What are you going to do?
Yeah. Hey, look, everybody has a vice. Mine is the opposite of ice.
Ice. That's it. Oh, Sydney Opera House, the piano microphone shows. The first show I was, you know, when the opera house is set up and it's got like those choir seating, like behind the stage and on the side, I was in, I think the third row, like over Prince's behind him, like looking over his right shoulder, which was really good. I couldn't see his face much, but I could see most of what he was playing, which was great.
Copying his licks and stuff.
Oh, yeah, everything. Copied it all in my brain, which doesn't work anymore. But it was good just watching his hands play all that stuff. And then the second show I was in, I think seventh or eighth row, pretty much in the middle. So I was looking like straight up at his face. So again, then I couldn't see his hands, but then I saw all the face expressions and everything. So that was great from that view. Then there were four shows in Sydney. I only got to three. The State Theatre one the next night, me and Toe Jam and a couple other people. We were literally in the back row of the State Theatre. The back row, like I was leaning against the wall at the back, at the top. Prince was way down there, but the sound was unbelievable. The sound in there was better than in the Opera House. It sounded so good.
Yeah, the Opera House can not sound so good, depending on the show.
Especially when he's just banging away on all these low notes on the piano. It gets a bit muddy, and I mean, it was still good, but State Theatre sounded amazing.
Well, do you know what I found really weird? That he used his keyboard. You know, it's I assume it's a Motif, because all those American artists love their Yamaha Motifs, you know, in a
and
shell.
And he mixed it in with the synth or something, yeah.
Yeah, he had the string. That's what made me twig. And I went, oh, this is kind of like schmaltzy string pad over the top. Wait a minute, he's playing a keyboard. I understand why you would, for sonic reasons, not having to mic the piano. But when you're in a venue like that, why not mic the bloody piano?
Yeah.
That's what Herbie would do. Just saying.
yeah. What are you doing? But it was crazy, those shows.
We were so lucky to get them.
You can thank us for those shows.
I thank you guys for a lot. I'm looking forward to thanking you for your Madhouse episodes.
If that ever happens. They'll come one day. We'll get there.
You're going to run out of other stuff. You'll be going, okay, we've reviewed Des Dickerson's book. What? Adam says Madhouse. Let's review the Oak Tree 12-inch. And
oh, gosh. We'll get there.
Let's review the video clip to Bang Bang.
I would like to make an introduction.
Let's go track by track on Raise Up. There you go. That'd be something.
is that Larry?
That's Larry's 2012, yeah,
it's when he re-recorded half those songs. And I asked him about that, and he was like, well, I don't own the rights to them or to those recordings, so I had to re-record them.
So many people have done that. Roy Orbison did that, I think, around 85, 86, I want to say. Because again, same thing. He just couldn't get hold of the original tapes, and whoever had them wasn't giving them up. So he just re-recorded like all his biggest hits and put out like a greatest hits album.
Was that the album? Was that called Roy Under the Joy Fantastic?
I think that was it, yeah.
When we're talking about Sacrifice of Victor earlier, and you said that that was one of the, you know, the professional shot after shows, even Rave is shot like crap. Like, it's not an after show per se.
Rave is horrible because
the editing,
it's like Sign of the Times, it's a total setup.
At least Sign of the Times is a good polished product. It's well edited and it's well shot. Rave is not well edited nor well shot.
Well, at least it's a step up from Aladdin.
Yeah, Aladdin is also similar.
How did he go from Rave to Aladdin, though? Because that's just a bunch of, you know, drunk people in the audience with like high 8 handycams just wandering around filming the floor.
I think it actually looks better than Rave. I'll take Aladdin over Rave.
Nah, I would.
Rave is really bad. But I'm excited to see this German Blu-ray special edition
Sign of the Times.
That'll be amazing. When will that footage that's in the Omnibus BBC documentary of Camden after when Ron Wood got up and when they're checking the ladder and all that, where's that footage? I want to see that entire sound check and that entire after show. That would be incredible because he was absolutely at the peak of his powers at that time, and the band was so good, that post-revolution lineup.
Taylor Dane, all that stuff. No, not Taylor Dane. Mika Paris,
yeah. Yeah, wow.
The first time I watched that on a rubbish VHS copy, but still, it was so good.
when you've seen the musical Portrait enough times, you start realizing who doesn't have anything to say. And I would say Randy Newman is the most pointless person in there. He's like, yeah, you know, they ought to notice him a little more. You know, you could tell he couldn't be a bad guy. Like, why are you here? I mean, sure, Randy Newman is Randy Newman and he's fantastic. But as an authority on Prince, I feel his insights were not that.
Yeah.
Notice him a little bit more. What?
Yeah,
that's what made the cut. Imagine what didn't make the cut. Oh, you know, wears a lot of purple, you know. I've noticed that.
Didn't he have that album about purple something? Yeah. I always remember Miles.
Oh, no, it wasn't. It just looked purple. 1999. Yeah, that one.
No, yeah, that one. Confused. I always remember Miles Davis in that thing. He was a funny guy.
Oh, he's so funny. Yeah. Miles.
Yeah, see, there's a whole bunch of stuff that we want to hear as well.
Eric told me about when Miles came to dinner at Prince's house and Prince invited Eric along because he couldn't not. Eric had pretty much introduced him to the music of Miles Davis and made him listen to all this extremely hip shit. And John L. Nelson was there as well.
I think I might have heard this on some podcast or some interview that Eric did. And was Sheila there as well? Was Sheila? Or
I'm not sure if Sheila was there. I think he mentioned Sheila.
But Prince's dad was there. Yeah.
And he tried to ask Miles a question about, you know, I can't remember who the musician was, but it was some jazz musician. He goes, oh, you know, do you listen to, I forget who it was. Somebody's probably listening to this yelling it at their computer. Adam, it's Hank Mobley.
We can't hear you.
Anyway, he goes, you know, do you listen to this person? And Miles is like, why the hell would I listen to him? Just like yelled at him. And apparently Prince just like burst out laughing, like fell off his chair, was in hysterics. But Eric felt really awkward because he's like, oh my God, Miles Davis has just humiliated Prince's dad in front of everybody. And he said it was a really awkward moment for him, but Prince just like broke up. And it was the funniest response. Poor guy. And then Eric was like, oh, I've got this painting that Miles did. And he showed Eric in his apartment. He has one of Miles' original artworks just on his wall. Eric has just such a deep connection to that music. We talked so much about the types of jazz that Eric likes, Afro-Cuban stuff, Weather Report. And, you know, he absolutely worships George Clinton and, you know, Fred Wesley and Maceo as a horn section. It was just really awesome to get an insight into Eric's other musical influences. You know, we know about many of them that he's spoken about, but you know, I feel really fortunate to have been able to discuss that stuff in depth with him.
That would be good.
Did I tell you about when I got my picture with Eric in Minneapolis the other week?
Mm-mm.
I was at the Ice House seeing LP Music, and Eric played a little bit of Pacemaker, which is his original composition that it contains the horn line from Rock Hard in a Funky Place.
Prince
just appropriated. So when I first made contact with Eric, I said, hey, I just think that Rock Hard in a Funky Place is like the best horn line ever written. It's amazing. And he goes, oh, you know, it's from this tune I wrote called Pacemaker. And he actually sent me the music, the lead sheet of Rock Hard in a Funky Place. And I have it, says EJL up the top in this computer font, you know. And so every time I talk to Eric, I'm like, hey, when are you going to play Pacemaker? Hey, when are you going to play Pacemaker? And I'm always bugging him. And I know that LP Music have recorded it, but they didn't put it on their record. And I think they want to do it even better because it's this expansive composition. It's not just that horn riff. There's all these other parts and it's this real Latin number. And anyway, Eric is at the Ice House in Minneapolis. I'm there on the mezzanine level and he starts playing. He starts playing Rock on the Funky Place real fast. And I'm filming at the time. I've got this all on my phone, actually. I just happened to be like filming as they were playing because it was an amazing moment of the gig. And I thought, oh, man, I've got to remember this later. And I just happened to get this on camera. It was filled with joy. I think I screamed on the recording. And afterwards, I went up to Eric and I said, Eric, you know, I'm sorry to be a fanboy, but can I get my picture with you? Like, I've had my picture with Eric a few times and you know, we've recorded together for crying out loud, but I still couldn't help it. I just really want to get a picture with Eric. Amazing night. And I'm getting ready to take this selfie and there's this voice behind me. It goes, oh, do you want me to take that? I turned around. It's Steve Park. Steve Park is at the gig. He's standing right behind there and he goes, oh, do you want me to help? I'll take a picture of you. And I'm like, yes. So I've got this picture of me and Eric where I'm grinning like a total madman, not because I'm getting my picture taken with one of my musical heroes, but photo by Steve Park.
Oh, God.
And Steve was an incredibly nice guy. I kept bumping into him in that week because we kept going to the same sort of things. And yeah, what a mellow dude. And he was is so lovely to take that picture just to offer. Mm. So, yeah. So I've been photographed by Steve Park. No big deal.
No big deal. Yeah.
I could bring out a book and it would be like the Graffiti Bridge sheet music. It would just be the same picture of me and Eric Leeds on every page. Photo book by Steve Park, coffee table, hardcover. Adam Rudiger from Lake Minnetonka.
100 pages, every page is the same photo. Yeah. Here's just another little bit. This is an outtake. It's an official outtake from the Peach and Black podcast when we talked to Adam. This is when he talked about meeting Wendy, Lisa, and the Revolution. I think Lisa specifically. So here we go.
I got to meet her for about 2 seconds just a few months ago when the Revolution rocked up to get their picture taken with their star outside First Avenue. And I had a bit of a gushy moment. I was just like, oh, my God, Lisa, you're amazing. You've been an inspiration to me. And I have a band in Melbourne. We're called Lake Minnetonka. And I'm like, oh, no, it sounds like I'm trying to network.
But I just got
this
a
my
bit,
business card.
I just got a bit carried away, and then I was like, "Can I get a picture with you, please?" Yeah,
that's nice.
And then
that was funny.
I was getting a ride to Paisley Park with Dr. Fink, and he wanted to go right then. So I wanted to hang out and chat to Wendy, but I didn't get to because I had to get my ride, which was also cool.
You'll be back.
I'll be back. I'm planning on taking the band over there next year because it was a great vibe. Ooh. And I met quite a few musicians who were quite keen to share a bill with us and things. And I've been to a bunch of the venues now and I'm sort of like starting to get an idea of where we would play and what we would do. You know, I've been over twice now. So, yeah, it's time. Let's just
We're thinking about going to play
Bunkers.
2020.
I'd love to play Bunkers. I'd play the Ice House. I'd play, you know, Fine Line would be amazing.
Fine Line.
Dakota. There's a lot of great venues. It's very much like Melbourne, actually.
Nice.
And not like Sydney at all.
No, not like Sydney at all. I mean, I don't want to diss you guys, but yeah.
No, it's well deserved.
No. Sydney's horrible.
It is.
For music venues, at least, anyway. Yeah. What else can we talk about?
I don't know, Captain. There's lots, but you know, maybe we should leave the crowd wanting more. I mean, we covered a lot of territory. I think we hopped around a lot, but I think we've both got the same kind of keen archival Prince related minds that can handle that kind of time hopping.
Yeah, you there'll be a few people just like you're all over the place. It's like, oh, keep up. It's not that hard. What do you do?
Yeah, it's not that hard. You just got to like obsess over Prince for like 20 years plus.
Yeah. Oh, before we go, what was the first thing you heard by Prince and you, or should that start the next show?
That's easy. Well, I saw Batman, but I didn't know Prince at the time.
This is the same story.
But
I saw Batman, and I didn't know it was a guy called Prince. Yeah, continue.
And then my sister had a CD called 1990 Beat the Heat. A hits compilation had Margaret Ehrlich and it had this other stuff. It had Thieves in the Temple. And I listened to Thieves in the Temple, but I remember seeing a little picture of Prince from the Thieves in the Temple video. You know, they had sort of the faces of the artists in little boxes on the cover of this compilation. And I remember thinking, who's that sleazy looking guy with the long hair and the sort of the 5 o'clock shadow? And I was like, no, I'm going to listen to that guy. And then cut to 1 year later, one day I came home from school, I turned on Video Hits and I saw Cream And that was the best thing that I had ever seen in my life up until that point. It was the best thing I'd heard. It was the best thing I'd seen. I couldn't get over his outfit. I couldn't get over just how fucking awesome that song was, how sexy those girls were. Just the whole thing. I just swallowed it. Hook, line, and sinker, the whole shtick.
The whole 10-minute video.
Yeah. And then I just started taping MTV when it was on the weekend with Richard Wilkins every week and just watching it in fast forward in case there was a new Prince video. And I continued that habit for years. So it was Cream that really made the connection. And then I got Diamonds and Pearls and a Discman for Christmas that year. And for some reason, I just listened to Diamonds and Pearls endlessly, but for some reason, I just didn't like, it's not that I didn't even like them. I just didn't want to listen to them for some reason. I skipped Money Don't Matter Tonight and Live for Love all the time. I just jump over them. I don't know why. Jughead, no worries. Push, no worries.
Yeah.
But then I just got over that and I started listening to them and I was like, yeah, they're good. What's my problem? And then I listened to the whole thing. But that was my one weird quirk with listening to Diamonds and Pearls for some reason. I don't know why.
Money Don't Matter Tonight is a real like studio track though. Like even One Night Alone, like every time he attempted to play it live, like half the time he'd just get like halfway through the first verse and he's like, nah.
Nah, over it. I'm going to play.
It's not working.
I'm going to play You Want Me, a song you've never heard before and will never hear again. And only a bit of it. You know, he does that on Aladdin. Yeah.
It was Diamonds and Pearls. Well, actually, right. It wasn't cool. Diamonds and Pearls. It was, I saw Bat Dance. Didn't know who he was. That's fine. It was just another song. But it was literally like June. It must have been 90. It was May or June 92. And my friend at school, Darren, his brother Dave was a massive Prince fan and he'd given Darren this cassette tape and I don't know what tape it was. I guess it was Love Sexy because it had Alphabet Street on it. And one day he brought me and he played me Alphabet Street like on his cassette on the Walkman. And I'm just like, what the hell is this? This is bloody excellent. And from then, you know, the thing that I will regret forever is this is literally like weeks after Prince left Australia on the Diamonds and Pearls tour. So I just missed that spectacular bloody show by like, you know, if he'd played that tape to me 2 months earlier, I would have gone to Diamonds would have and made Pearls.
It. Yeah.
But no, he had to play it later and I missed it. But yeah.
I saw Diamonds and Pearls tour, but I was too young to go to the after show.
Oh.
And I've got a bootleg of that concert from a guy at the Camberwell Market on cassette tape. But I had a readings in St. Kilda on Ackland Street used to be a bookstore called Cosmos or a music store as well. And they had a weird cassette that had Parade on one side and Love Sexy on the other. It was like a long play cassette.
I used
to listen to Parade all the time. I have a weird habit of skipping things. So now I just listen to Parade and I'd rewind and I'd listen to it again. Then one day my friend Dave said, have you listened to Love Sexy? And I said, yeah, no, kind of like, yeah, not properly. He goes, have you heard that line about shake your body like a horny pony? I was like, no. And then I had to like listen to Love Sexy like properly just to find that line. Of course, that line is in Alphabet Street. And Alphabet Street is one of my top five Prince songs. It's amazing. I love it so much. It's incredible. So that's my Love Sexy story. But it was just like his disbelief. You know, we used to listen to Prince and be like, oh my God, did he really say that? Oh God, he's so edgy. Big old liar. Oh, okay. I can't believe he said that. Dirty fat banker. Oh, wow. He's really sticking it to him, isn't he?
Oh, yeah. So offensive.
He's going to strike his enemies down. I could really believe he's capable of this violence.
Yeah.
My Name is Prince came out, when the video came out of My Name is Prince, I was like, man, he's getting really dark. Like, wow.
Yeah.
He's like doing the Detroit crawl in a puddle of water. Which is still awesome. Like, that's a great video. It's great.
It's a great video with like burning trash cans and like
burning underwear.
Sunny T playing the cloud bass. Sunny T
playing the cloud bass. Oh, I know. Come that on. Is the best Easter egg. That's amazing.
And, you know what's insane is like that's literally 1 second in like a 7-minute video, and like that's the one thing we talk about. That's how insane we are.
That's because that's your only chance to see the cloud bass, apart from why you want to treat me so bad.
Yeah.
But I will take all three verses of Tony M on that track.
Oh shit, yeah. And
That rap is fantastic. I love it. I will not hear a bad word against it.
No.
I've been a Tony M apologist for a long time, and I'm showing no signs of turning back.
No, that whole three verses is just, I remember the first time that I heard that and the flow as well. Like the last line of the flow where he just like
skipping and jumping around so much they bring it on. That's very difficult. Anybody that wants to diss Tony M, I want them to perform the last line of the flow in at that tempo.
Yeah, come on. Bring it on.
Yep. High five, Captain.
Bang.
Thank you, man. Okay, so
next time we're going to talk about Love Sexy and about a million other things.
All right. Great. Looking forward to it.
Okay. The end. Here is the theme music. First of all, let's just start with saying that on the day we are recording this, this is the exact day that possibly one of your favourite songs, In a Large Room with No Light, was re-released back in 2009. Tell us about why that song is so great, because I saw you play it. It's good.
Okay, I'll try and sum it up without going on too long. It was on a bootleg that I got, one of the first bootlegs when I discovered bootlegs in the late 90s.
Bootlegs.
Yes, oh my God, I know. But I didn't inhale. It was on Jewel Box, Volume 1.
Ah, the classic.
It was amazing. Ooh. And the sound quality was bad, but I didn't care. And I just think it was one of the vault classics that, you know, should have seen the light of day by now. And I think Eric Leeds told me that Sheila E. was responsible for that part at the end, the outro, that's in like 9/8. Because Prince doesn't often use different time signatures. Sometimes you get a 3/4, like a waltz, like Under the Cherry Moon. And sometimes you get kind of like a 12/8 kind of bluesy thing or a 6/8. But most of the time he sticks to 4/4. But that part is really cool. And then when it came out,
that's probably one of the only times he's ever done such a out there time signature.
Eric blamed Sheila, said that was a Sheila groove that she came up with. So I love it for that reason. And then when he started performing it live again in 2009 at Montreux, I thought that might be our kind of get out of jail free card, because I always wanted to record it, but you're not allowed to record something that has never been released if it's a cover, because the artist has first dibs. So none of us are ever actually have meant to have been able to hear it until 2009. And then I started investigating whether, because it had been streamed officially on the Montreux website, that would constitute...
Is it now okay?
And is it now okay? And the advice I got was that best not to tangle with Prince's lawyers over such a thing, because it's a grey area. And any grey area, they're probably going to win. So we recorded our version of that at our very first recording session, where we recorded Heavy Bread and Hecka Buff and a cover of 10 and a cover of Mutiny. And we also recorded Large Room with No Light, but it remains in our vault for the aforementioned reasons. But I reckon we could re-record it now.
The Minnetonka vault.
The Minnetonka vault. And I reckon it would be heaps better if we recorded it now, because the band had just got together. So we're far more settled and mature.
And you've played it live a load of times, so you've really got a handle on it now.
We've given it a rest from time to time, but it's been part of our repertoire since the very beginning.